The stranger has been already asked the same question by Theodorus and Theaetetus, and he at once replies that they are thought to be three, but to explain the difference fully would take time. He is pressed to give this fuller explanation, either in the form of a speech, or of question and answer. He prefers the latter, and chooses as his respondent Theaetetus, whom he already knows, and who is recommended to him by Socrates. "We are agreed," he says, "about the name sophist, but we may not be equally agreed about his nature. Great subjects should be approached through familiar examples, and, considering that he is a creature not easily caught, I think that, before approaching him, we should try our hand upon some more obvious animal, who may be made the subject of logical experiment. Shall we say an angler?" "Very good. In the first place, the angler is an artist, and there are two kinds of art: productive art, which includes husbandry, manufactures, imitations, and acquisitive art, which includes learning, trading, fighting, hunting. The angler's is an acquisitive art, and acquisition may be effected either by exchange or by conquest, in the latter case, either by force or craft. Conquest by craft is called hunting, and of hunting there is one kind which pursues inanimate, and another which pursues animate objects, and animate objects may be either land animals or water animals, and water animals either fly over the water or live in the water. The hunting of the last is called fishing, and of fishing, one kind uses enclosures, catching the fish in nets and baskets, and another kind strikes them either with spears by night, or with barbed spears or barbed hooks by day. The barbed spears are impelled from above, the barbed hooks are jerked into the head and lips of the fish, which are then drawn from below upwards. Thus, by a series of divisions, we have arrived at the definition of the angler's art. And now by the help of this example we may proceed to bring to light the nature of the sophist. Like the angler, he is an artist, and the resemblance does not end here. For they are both hunters, and hunters of animals, the one of water, and the other of land animals. But at this point they diverge, the one going to the sea and the rivers, and the other to the rivers of wealth and rich meadowlands, in which generous youth abide. On land you may hunt tame animals, or you may hunt wild animals. And man is a tame animal, and he may be hunted either by force or persuasion, either by the pirate, man-stealer, soldier, or by the lawyer, orator, talker. The latter use persuasion, and persuasion is either private or public. Of the private practitioners of the art, some bring gifts to those whom they hunt. These are lovers. And others take hire, and some of these flatter, and in return are fed. Others profess to teach virtue and receive a round sum. And who are these last? Tell me who. Have we not unearthed the sophist? But he is a many-sided creature, and may still be traced in another line of descent. The acquisitive art had a branch of exchange as well as of hunting, and exchange is either giving or selling, and the seller is either a manufacturer or a merchant, and the merchant either retails or exports, and the exporter may export either food for the body or food for the mind. And of this trading in food for the mind, one kind may be termed the art of display, and another the art of selling learning, and learning may be a learning of the arts or of virtue. The seller of the arts may be called an art seller, the seller of virtue, a sophist. Again, there is a third line, in which a sophist may be traced. Far is he less a sophist when, instead of exporting his wares to another country, he stays at home, and retails goods, which he not only buys of others, but manufactures himself. Or he may be descended from the acquisitive art in the combative line, through the pugnacious, the controversial, the disputatious arts, and he will be found at last in the heuristic section of the latter, and in that division of it which disputes in private for gain about the general principles of right and wrong. And still there is a track of him which has not yet been followed out by us. Do not our household servants talk of sifting, straining, winnowing? And they also speak of carding, spinning, and the like. All these are processes of division, and of division there are two kinds, one in which like is divided from like, and another in which the good is separated from the bad. The latter of the two is termed purification, and again, of purification, there are two sorts, of animate bodies, which may be internal or external, and of inanimate. Medicine and gymnastic are the internal purifications of the animate, and bathing the external, and of the inanimate, fulling and cleaning, and other humble processes, some of which have ludicrous names. Not that dialectic is a respecter of names or persons, or a despiser of humble occupations, nor does she think much of the greater or less benefits conferred by them. For her aim is knowledge. She wants to know how the arts are related to one another, and would quite as soon learn the nature of hunting from the vermin destroyer as from the general. And she only desires to have a general name, which shall distinguish purifications of the soul from purifications of the body. Now purification is the taking away of evil, and there are two kinds of evil in the soul, the one answering to disease in the body, and the other to deformity. Disease is the discord or war of opposite principles in the soul, and deformity is the want of symmetry, or failure in the attainment of a mark or measure. The latter arises from ignorance, and no one is voluntarily ignorant. Ignorance is only the aberration of the soul moving towards knowledge. And as medicine cures the diseases, and gymnastic the deformity of the body, so correction cures the injustice, and education, which differs among the Hellenes from mere instruction in the arts, cures the ignorance of the soul. Again, ignorance is twofold: simple ignorance, and ignorance having the conceit of knowledge. And education is also twofold. There is the old-fashioned moral training of our forefathers, which was very troublesome, and not very successful, and another, of a more subtle nature, which proceeds upon a notion that all ignorance is involuntary. The latter convicts a man out of his own mouth, by pointing out to him his inconsistencies and contradictions, and the consequence is that he quarrels with himself, instead of quarrelling with his neighbours, and is cured of prejudices and obstructions by a mode of treatment which is equally entertaining and effectual. The physician of the soul is aware that his patient will receive no nourishment, unless he has been cleaned out, and the soul of the great king himself, if he has not undergone this purification, is unclean and impure. And who are the ministers of the purification? Sophists I may not call them. Yet they bear about the same likeness to sophists as the dog, who is the gentlest of animals, does to the wolf, who is the fiercest. Comparisons are slippery things, but for the present let us assume the resemblance of the two, which may probably be disallowed hereafter. And so, from division comes purification, and from this, mental purification, and from mental purification, instruction, and from instruction, education, and from education, the nobly descended art of sophistry, which is engaged in the detection of conceit. I do not, however, think that we have yet found the sophist, or that his will ultimately prove to be the desired art of education, but neither do I think that he can long escape me, for every way is blocked. Before we make the final assault, let us take breath, and reckon up the many forms which he has assumed. 1. He was the paid hunter of wealth and birth. 2. He was the trader in the goods of the soul. 3. He was the retailer of them. 4. He was the manufacturer of his own learned wares. 5. He was the disputant. And 6. He was the purger away of prejudices, although this latter point is admitted to be doubtful. 1. Now, there must surely be something wrong in the professor of any art, having so many names and kinds of knowledge. Does not the very number of them imply that the nature of his art is not understood? And that we may not be involved in the till's understanding, let us observe which of his characteristics is the most prominent. Above all things, he is a disputant. He will dispute and teach others to dispute about things visible and invisible, about man, about the gods, about politics, about law, about wrestling, about all things. But can he know all things? He cannot. How then can he dispute satisfactorily with anyone who knows? Impossible. Then what is the trick of his art, And why does he receive money from his admirers? Because he is believed by them to know all things. You mean to say that he seems to have a knowledge of them? Yes. Suppose a person were to say, not that he would dispute about all things, but that he would make all things, you and me, and all other creatures, the earth and the heavens and the gods, and I would sell them all for a few pence, this would be a great jest, but not greater than if he said that he knew all things, and could teach them in a short time, and at a small cost. For all imitation is a jest, and the most graceful form of jest. Now the painter is a man who professes to make all things, and children, who see his pictures at a distance, sometimes take them for realities, and the sophist pretends to know all things, and he too, can deceive young men, who are still at a distance from the truth, not through their eyes, but through their ears, by the mummery of words, and induce them to believe him. But as they grow older, and come into contact with realities, they learn by experience the futility of his pretensions. The sophist, then, has not real knowledge. He is only an imitator, or image maker. And now, having got him in a corner of the dialectical net, let us divide and subdivide until we catch him. Of image making there are two kinds, the art of making likenesses, and the art of making appearances. The latter may be illustrated by sculpture and painting, which often use illusions, and alter the proportions of figures, in order to adapt their works to the eye. And the sophist also uses illusions, and his imitations are apparent and not real. But how can anything be an appearance only? Here arises a difficulty which has always beset the subject of appearances. For the argument is asserting the existence of not being. And this is what the great Parmenides was all his life denying in prose, and also in verse. You will never find, he says, that not being is. And the words prove themselves. Not being cannot be attributed to any being, for how can any being be wholly abstracted from being? Again, in every predication there is an attribution of singular or plural. But number is the most real of all things, and cannot be attributed to not being. Therefore not being cannot be predicated or expressed, for how can we say is, are not, without number? And now arises the greatest difficulty of all. If not being is inconceivable, how can not being be refuted? And am I not contradicting myself at this moment, in speaking either in the singular or the plural of that to which I deny both plurality and unity? You, Theaetetus, have the might of youth, and I conjure you to exert yourself, and, if you can, to find an expression for not being which does not imply being a number. But I cannot. Then the sophist must be left in his hole. We may call him an image maker if we please, but he will only say, and pray, what is an image? And we shall reply, a reflection in the water, or in a mirror. And he will say, let us shut our eyes and open our minds. What is the common notion of all images? I should answer, such another, made in the likeness of the true. Real or not real? Not real, at least, not in a true sense. And the real is, and the not real is not? Yes. Then a likeness is really unreal, and essentially not. Here is a pretty complication of being and not being, in which the many-headed sophist has entangled us. He will at once point out that he is compelling us to contradict ourselves by affirming being of not being. I think that we must cease to look for him in the class of imitators. But ought we to give him up? I should say, certainly not. Then I fear that I must lay hands on my father Parmenides. But do not call me a parricide, for there is no way out of the difficulty except to show that in some sense not being is. And if this is not admitted, no one can speak of falsehood or false opinion, or imitation, without falling into a contradiction. You observe how unwilling I am to undertake the task, for I know that I am exposing myself to the charge of inconsistency in asserting the being of not being. But if I am to make the attempt, I think that I had better begin at the beginning. Lightly in the days of our youth, Parmenides and others told us tales about the origin of the universe. One spoke of three principles warring, and at peace again, marrying and begetting children, another of two principles, hot and cold, dry and moist, which also formed relationships. There were the elitics in our part of the world, saying that all things are one, whose doctrine begins with Xenophon's, and is even older. Ionian, and, more recently, Sicilian muses speak of a one, and many which are held together by enmity and friendship, ever parting, ever meeting. Some of them do not insist on the perpetual strife, but adopt a gentler strain, and speak of alternation only. Whether they are right or not, who can say? But one thing we can say, that they went on their way without much caring, whether we understood them or not. For tell me, Theaetetus, do you understand what they mean by their assertion of unity, or by their combinations and separations of two or more principles? I used to think, when I was young, that I knew all about not being, and now I am in great difficulties even about being. Let us proceed first to the examination of being. Turning to the dualist philosophers, we say to them, is being a third element besides hot and cold, or do you identify one or both of the two elements with being? At any rate, you can hardly avoid resolving them into one. Let us next interrogate the patrons of the one. To them we say, are being and one two different names for the same thing? But how can there be two names, when there is nothing but one? Or you may identify them, but then the name will be either the name of nothing or of itself, i.e. of a name. Again, the notion of being is conceived of as a whole, in the words of Parmenides, like every way unto a rounded sphere. And a whole has parts, but that which has parts is not one, for unity has no parts. Is being, then, one, because the parts of being are one, or shall we say that being is not a whole? In the former case, one is made up of parts, and in the latter there is still plurality, viz. Being, and a whole which is apart from being. And being, if not all things, lacks something of the nature of being, and becomes not being. Nor can being ever have come into existence, for nothing comes into existence except as a whole. Nor can being have number, for that which has number is a whole or sum of number. These are a few of the difficulties which are accumulating one upon another in the consideration of being. We may proceed now to the less exact sort of philosophers. Some of them drag down everything to earth, and carry on a war like that of the giants, grasping rocks and oaks in their hands. Their adversaries defend themselves warily from an invisible world, and reduce the substances of their opponents to the minutest fractions, until they are lost in generation and flux. The latter sort are civil people enough. But the materialists are rude, and ignorant of dialectics. They must be taught how to argue, before they can answer. Yet, for the sake of the argument, we may assume them to be better than they are, and able to give an account of themselves. They admit the existence of a mortal living creature, which is a body containing a soul, and to this, they would not refuse to attribute qualities, wisdom, folly, justice and injustice. The soul, as they say, has a kind of body, but they do not like to assert of these qualities of the soul, either that they are corporeal, or that they have no existence. At this point they begin to make distinctions. Sons of earth, we say to them, if both visible and invisible qualities exist, what is the common nature which is attributed to them by the term being or existence? And, as they are incapable of answering this question, we may as well reply for them, that being is the power of doing or suffering. Then we turn to the friends of ideas. To them we say, you distinguish becoming from being. Yes, they will reply. And in becoming you participate through the bodily senses, and in being, by thought and the mind. Yes. And you mean by the word participation a power of doing or suffering? To this they answer, I am acquainted with them, Theaetetus, and know their ways better than you do, that being can neither do nor suffer, though becoming may. And we rejoin, does not the soul know? And is not being known? And are not knowing, and being known active and passive? That which is known is affected by knowledge, and therefore is in motion. And, indeed, how can we imagine that perfect being, is a mere everlasting form, devoid of motion and soul, for there can be no thought without soul, nor can soul be devoid of motion. But neither can thought or mind be devoid of some principle of rest or stability. And as children say entreatingly, give us both, so the philosopher must include both the movable and immovable in his idea of being. And yet, alas, he and we are in the same difficulty with which we reproached the dualists, for motion and rest are contradictions. How then can they both exist? Does he who affirms this mean to say that motion is rest, or rest motion? No, he means to assert the existence of some third thing, different from them both, which neither rests nor moves. But how can there be anything which neither rests nor moves? Here is a second difficulty about being, quite as great as that about not being. And we may hope that any light which is thrown upon the one may extend to the other. Leaving them for the present, let us inquire what we mean by giving many names to the same thing, e.g. white, good, tall, to man, out of which Tyro's old and young derive such a feast of amusement. Their meek minds refuse to predicate anything of anything. They say that good is good, and man is man, and that to affirm one of the other would be making the many one and the one many. Let us place them in a class with our previous opponents, and interrogate both of them at once. Shall we assume, 1, that being and rest and motion, and all other things, are incommunicable with one another, or, 2, that they all have indiscriminate communion, or, 3, that there is communion of some, and not of others? And we will consider the first hypothesis first of all. 1. If we suppose the universal separation of kinds, all theories alike are swept away. The patrons of a single principle of rest or of motion, or of a plurality of immutable ideas, all alike have the ground cut from under them. And all creators of the universe by theories of composition and division, whether out of or into a finite or infinite number of elemental forms, in all alternation or continuance, share the same fate. Most ridiculous is the discomfiture which attends the opponents of predication, who, like the ventriloquist oracles, have the voice that answers them in their own breast. For they cannot help using the words is, apart from others, and the like, and their adversaries are thus saved the trouble of refuting them. But, too, if all things have communion with all things, motion will rest, and rest will move. Here is a reductio ad absurdum. 2 out of the 3 hypotheses are thus seen to be false. The third, 3, remains, which affirms that only certain things communicate with certain other things. In the alphabet and the scale there are some letters, and notes which combine with others, and some which do not, and the laws according to which they combine, or are separated are known to the grammarian and musician. And there is a science which teaches not only what notes and letters, but what classes admit of combination with one another, and what not. This is a noble science, on which we have stumbled unawares. In seeking after the sophist we have found the philosopher. He is the master who discerns one whole, or form pervading a scattered multitude, and many such wholes combined under a higher one, and many entirely apart. He is the true dialectician. Like the sophist, he is hard to recognize, though for the opposite reasons. The sophist runs away into the obscurity of not being, the philosopher is dark from excess of light. And now, leaving him, we will return to our pursuit of the sophist. Agreeing in the truth of the third hypothesis, that some things have communion and others not, and that some may have communion with all, let us examine the most important kinds which are capable of admixture. And in this way we may perhaps find out a sense in which not being may be affirmed to have being. Now the highest kinds are being, rest, motion, and of these, rest and motion exclude each other, but both of them are included in being, and again, they are the same with themselves, and the other of each other. What is the meaning of these words, same and other? Are there 2 more kinds, to be added to the 3 others? For sameness cannot be either rest or motion, because predicated both of rest and motion, nor yet being, because if being were attributed to both of them, we should attribute sameness to both of them. nor can other be identified with being, for then other, which is relative, would have the absoluteness of being. Therefore we must assume a fifth principle, which is universal, and runs through all things, for each thing is other than all other things. Thus there are five principles: 1. Being, 2. Motion, which is not, 3. Rest, and because participating both in the same and other, is and is not, 4. The same with itself, and is not, 5. Other than the other. And motion is not being, but partakes of being, and therefore is and is not in the most absolute sense. Thus we have discovered, that not being, is the principle of the other which runs through all things, being not excepted. And being is one thing, and not being includes, and is all other things. And not being, is not the opposite of being, but only the other. Knowledge has many branches, and the other or difference has as many, each of which is described, by prefixing the word, not to some kind of knowledge. The not beautiful is as real as the beautiful, the not just as the just. And the essence of the not beautiful is to be separated from, and opposed to a certain kind of existence which is termed beautiful. And this opposition and negation is the not being of which we are in search, and is one kind of being. Thus, in spite of Parmenides, we have not only discovered the existence, but also the nature of not being, that nature we have found to be relation. In the communion of different kinds, being and other mutually interpenetrate, other is, but is other than being, and other than each and all of the remaining kinds, and therefore in an infinity of ways is not. And the argument has shown, that the pursuit of contradictions is childish and useless, and the very opposite of that higher spirit which criticizes the words of another according to the natural meaning of them. Nothing can be more unphilosophical than the denial of all communion of kinds. And we are fortunate in having established such a communion for another reason, because in continuing the hunt after the sophist we have to examine the nature of discourse, and there could be no discourse, if there were no communion. For the sophist, although he can no longer deny the existence of not being, may still affirm, that not being, cannot enter into discourse, and as he was arguing before, that there could be no such thing as falsehood, because there was no such thing as not being, he may continue to argue that there is no such thing as the art of image-making and fantastic, because not-being has no place in language. Hence arises the necessity of examining speech, opinion, and imagination.